This is Fresh Air. Stephen King's miniseries, The Stand, begins Sunday, so on this archive edition of the show, we're featuring our 1992 interview with him. King's books include The Shining, Misery, Carrie, Pet Sematary, and his recent collection of short stories, Nightmares and Dreamscapes. I think it must have been in the late 60s that you were given a 4F, a medical deferment, from the draft. And I believe you got the deferment for high blood pressure, limited vision, flat feet, and punctured eardrums. Makes you not exactly sound like the perfect physical specimen. Did you play that up for the draft board, or
no,
did
I really
you have
didn't.
All those problems?
I really didn't. You know, earlier on we were talking about pain, and it's only one eardrum that's punctured. And this is a very clear memory, even though it goes back to when I was about 3 years old. I had some sort of a terrible ear infection with a lot of infected matter behind the eardrum. And my mother took me to a doctor. And the same medication doesn't, the medication that they have for this sort of thing today didn't exist then. And they held me down. And my mother said, you have to be very brave now. And I remember the doctor coming with this needle that was about 6 inches long. And he slid it into my ear and punctured the eardrum with the needle and let out a quantity of infected pus and blood and that sort of thing. And the pain was like, if you can imagine a bee the size of a Cocker Spaniel sticking its stinger in your ear, it was like that. It went right through to the other side. It was excruciating. And a week later, my mother said, we have to go back and do it again. And I remember that I wet my pants. And then I went and I crawled in the closet, and she had to pull me out by the legs, and she got me down there to the doctors. And that time it took four people to hold me down, and I was only three, and they did it again. So I do have the punctured eardrums and scars in there and that sort of thing. And I've had a couple of nasty infantile type ear infections in there since then. But yeah, it's all true.
God, that sounds absolutely horrible.
It was. But enough about my pain. Let's talk about your pain.
Boy. So I guess, were you not a very physical kid when you were growing up?
No, I would say that I was, I don't know how to answer that. I was and I wasn't. I had a lot of the physical attributes of the absolute bookworm slash nerd slash wallflower, whatever you... In other words, I was overweight, I was kind of podgy, and I wore thick glasses. And at the same time, I became a big kid. I'm a big man. I stand about 6'4" and weigh about 210. And I think that I probably would have been more physical, more of an athlete and that sort of thing if I hadn't grown up in such small towns. But the baseball field was also a potato field, and the nearest high school was 7 miles away. That's where I went. And so extracurricular activities like baseball and football became sort of impossible. I was kind of a poor kid. My mother did not drive or have a driver's license, so we were kind of out of luck.
In high school, you were already writing, and you published something called The Village Vomit. What was it?
The Village Vomit was a satiric newspaper in which I made fun of a lot of teachers, and eventually I got picked up, as those things always do. That's one of the ways that we learn to either direct our impulses into more healthy channels or to do what I did, which was to try and do those things outside of school, since I knew that for me, healthy channels was a lost cause early on. But I was called into the principal's office, and the teachers I'd made fun of were there, and the ones who were younger teachers kind of laughed it off, and the ones who were older were just horrified, and there was a kind of, what's this younger generation coming to kind of reaction. And I was almost suspended from school, and in the end, the administration had mercy and suggested that maybe what I needed to do instead of perverting this God-given talent was to put it to work. So they got me a job with a local newspaper called the Lisbon Enterprise that published once weekly. This is a kind of small-town paper that has a lot of articles about 90-year-old ladies in nursing homes doing jigsaw puzzles and knitting afghans. And, you know, Miss Jolene Aubuchon's brother is coming to visit from Nebraska and that sort of thing. And I became the entire sports department. And the first column that I brought in was a column about a local high school kid who'd broken a basketball scoring record. And the editor took a look at it and went through it and struck out every adverb I'd put in there and most of the flowery descriptions and basically taught me my craft. And he did it in about 7 minutes.
What an incredibly smart thing for the principal or whoever to have done for you.
Well, I made money, too. I mean, it was I can't remember whether it was a quarter, a column inch, or what it was, but I wrote everything for the next year, whether it was Little League baseball, whether it was football, whether it was league bowling. That was me. That was Stephen King writing sports, and I filled up two or three pages with this stuff every week. And then years later, and I'm talking many years later, in 1989, my youngest son's Little League team won the state championship and went down to Bristol, Connecticut to compete in the Little League regional playoffs, I guess they call them. And I wrote it up for The New Yorker. I did a piece, and it sold to The New Yorker, let's put it that way. And the guy who edited the piece said, gee, you, for a novelist, you really write sports well. Where did you learn? And I said, well, that's what I was trained as, a sports writer, not a horror novelist.
Stephen King is my guest. We'll take a short break, then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Stephen King is my guest. Your first novel was Carrie. That was published when you were 26 years old. What made you head in the direction of horror fiction? I mean, especially after having started off on this newspaper where you were writing about sports.
Yes, I wrote horror all along. It's just something that I've done. I mean, there's a thing inside me that inclines naturally in that direction, like a compass needle toward true north. And I had written a lot of stories that I'd sold to men's magazines, like Cavalier and Dude and Gent, for $200, $300. And at that time, I was working in a laundry, actually washing motel sheets. And this was a step up from my first job as a guy who pumped gas at Interstate 95 and gave away free loaves of bread with a fill-up. So you can see that I was on my way up, you know, in the world of commerce. But the short stories were what was bridging the gap for my wife and I financially between my salary and what we needed to keep two little kids in diapers and amoxicillin for their ear infections and the rest of the stuff. And if you ask me why we ever had two kids, you know, before I even had a job as a teacher, the answer is I don't know. It isn't that they were unplanned. They weren't either planned or unplanned. They just... It seemed like a good idea at the time. Everything that I did up to about the age of 30, it seems like I did with a low-grade fever. I can't really remember the reasons for any of the things. I can only say that it seemed reasonable at the time. So I was writing these short stories, and one of them was supposed to be Carrie. And it was going to be, you know, a 4,000-word wonder and maybe a $200 check or something like that. And I began to see two things as I got into it. One was that I didn't know anything about girls in high school. And the other thing was that even if I did write it, it was going to be a lot longer than the market that I had in mind. So I threw it away and started to do something else that would, you know, produce a quick turnaround in terms of some money that we needed. And my wife was the one who fished it out of the wastebasket and looked at it and said, I think this is pretty good. And I said, well, I think it's all right, but I don't have time to do it, and I don't know enough. And she said, well, I'll tell you the stuff about the secret lives of girls, if you will, that you don't know. I'll give away all these lodge secrets.
Oh.
And you go back to work on it and finish it, because there's more money here eventually than there is in what you're doing. So I did, and she was right.
When you started publishing your novels, and people started reading them, and people who you knew understood more what went through your mind, the kind of thoughts that you had, did people start to see you differently?
I think so. There was a sort of, I won't say pulling away exactly, but a kind of, you'd see a kind of question in their eyes, sort of like, where are all the bodies buried, Steve? or there would be this sort of casual, by the way, Steve, what was your childhood like? Were you ever beaten? Did they burn you with cigarettes, or what was it? And I would say, really, I'm just like you are. And then they would step away.
That would be the worst news.
Yeah. Basically, all I'm doing is saying things that other people are afraid to say. The job's not much different than being a comedy writer. Basically, you say, what is the one thing that nobody wants to talk about that everybody will sort of raise their hands in horror? Well, not everybody, because you never get everybody, but what can I say that will be the literary equivalent of taking a fork and scraping it across a blackboard, you know, or making somebody bite in on a lemon? And when I find those things, generally the reaction from the readers or the people even who see the films is one of, thank you for saying that. Thank you for articulating that thought.
Your story, Misery, was about a psychotic fan who tortures her favorite writer because he's let her down with the plot of the new novel.
Mm-hmm.
and you, in a way, have become a kind of magnet for a few kind of crazy fans. Was the story of Misery based on one particular fear or one particular incident?
I don't think so. There are a number of things. Yes, I've been a lightning rod for a certain number of crazy people. We keep files on them. They are constant correspondents, and they want to be infinitely, intimately involved with my life or the lives of my family or whatever. Or they believe that they actually wrote the stories or that you're picking their brains telepathically or whatever it is. And you begin to realize the power of fans. And of course, it's just interacting with them, there is a kind of fan psychology that, for the object of that fan adulation, gets to be really, really uncomfortable sometimes. They want your autograph. They want to tell you how much they enjoy their stuff. And if you say, look, I'd love to sign your books, but I can't right now. I'm taking my family out to dinner, or I really have to be over here. Their reaction is, go to hell, you son of a bitch. You know, just like that, it changes.
Yeah, that's pretty frightening.
So you sense in the people who are the most devoted fans this really sort of churning need to identify emotionally or psychologically with the object of the fan worship. And sometimes this actual resentment, this feeling of you have what was really meant for me. In the best of all possible worlds, I would be you. And you see this quite often in the mail. So there's a lot of times this adulation and there's this really uncomfortable undercurrent of resentment at the same time.
In The Shining, you know, the all work and no play scene? They're at this kind of like haunted hotel, and you know, the guy's trying to write, and we think he's actually writing something, and his wife actually, he tells her, don't look at my manuscript. She goes and looks at it, and it's just pages and pages and pages of all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. And I see this part of the story as like a horror story about just the misery of living with somebody who has writer's block. But that's something you've probably never had. You're so
prolific.
Oh, yes,
I've had writer's block. It just doesn't show, and I think it very rarely does. It's one of those things that people don't talk about, like their bowel problems. And that's basically what writer's block is. It's a kind of mental constipation. So I have it, and I don't have it right now, and I'm very grateful when I don't. I'm always grateful when it passes, and when I do have a block, when I find that I can't work or I don't have an idea or I can't execute the ideas that I have, I just try to grin and bear it and tell myself it will pass, because it always has.
It seems like you're almost compulsive about the amount that you write.
It isn't almost. I am compulsive.
Right. Do you have to write every day?
No. But if I don't write for a week or a week and a half, there is a voice inside that starts to agitate for a return to the work. And it says all sorts of different things, but at the bottom, it's always the same. The real basic driving force behind that voice seems to be that if you don't use it, you'll lose it. That if I don't write, I'm going to find it impossible to go back and do it, that I will forget how. And I have no idea if there's any truth to that or not, because I've never taken a real long layoff. We talked about writer's block. I've had periods when I've written nothing but crap for as long as a year, but that's not the same thing as not writing at all or not being able to write. It's just, for my mind, it's just sort of working through a bad patch.
Stephen King, it's just been wonderful to talk with you. I thank you very, very much for talking with us.
It's been a great time. Thank you very much.
Novelist Stephen King, recorded in 1992. This Sunday night, ABC begins an 8-hour miniseries based on King's bestseller, The Stand. This is Fresh Air.